spanning the nerd world and feeding your fandom.
Crash landed.
From comics to video games.
From the cinematic universe to television.
This is Earth.
Connecting you to the biggest stars in the industry.
Something out there had discovered us.
It's time for the Down and Nerdy Podcast. Here's your host, James Witham.
Looks like Casper might not be the only friendly ghost in town. It's episode 280 of the Down and Nerdy Podcast. I'm James Witham, and kind of making half reference to the fact that everyone in the world seems to be getting ready for Halloween already. Have you been in a store lately? The Halloween stuff is already out in full force. So I thought, you know, let's talk some ghosts. Let's talk Ghosted in L.A. with Cinna Grace from Boom Studios. Actually, when I was at San Diego Comic-Con this year, I got a rare opportunity to actually talk to Cinna Grace, who, of course, is the writer and creator of Ghosted in L.A., and Ryan Parrott, who's doing great things with Power Rangers right now at Boom Studios. He's been on the show in the past as well. He's also doing the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Power Rangers crossover. So I talked to them together about their separate projects, but they started asking each other questions about stuff. It was really interesting. So I'm going to play a part of that interview for you actually this week, really focusing on Cinna Grace and Ghosted in LA, which comes out issue 3, I should say, on September the 11th. So not only that, going to recap some of the stuff that happened at D23 this past weekend. Also going to talk about, of course, the Mandalorian trailer and a whole bunch more stuff. But let's start things out with comics, of course. It's what we're reading next on the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
I'm Magdalene Masaggio, and you're listening to the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
Gotta love the sound it makes when you drag out the long box. How about when you hit that power button on the tablet or the laptop? I don't care what you're reading on. It's time for what we're reading, and we're going to start things out with a book that is coming back, kind of, maybe in name only. It's Batman Superman number one, the 2019 edition anyway. Joshua Williamson writing this one, Dave Marquez on the art, Alejandro Sanchez on the colors, and John J. Hill is going to be doing the lettering. Now, this does kind of rely heavily on the Batman Who Laughs maxi series that just happened, but I will say this. You don't absolutely positively have to have read that to understand what's going on in these pages. So don't feel like you, I mean, you really should because it was good anyway, and it's only 7 issues, but don't feel like you absolutely have to before you read this. It actually might make you want to go backwards. So basically, Batman's calling Superman in to help what seems like a minor crime at the time, which involves Batman Who Laughs. But with him, you know, there's always more to it than that. Now, all the while, they kind of wonder what would happen if one of them turned to the bad side and how they would be stopped. So there's really a push and pull, and it's really an interesting dynamic towards their relationship as a whole, which again is why I don't think you need to read the Batman Who Laughs to appreciate this. Now, once they actually find the Batman Who Laughs Batcave, which we do get to see, they make a really stunning discovery. And you know, these are spoiler-free reviews when I talk about comics. So I'm not going to spoil that for you, but they actually find out just how huge the scope of the plan the Batman Who Laughs has, and it's pretty epic. As a matter of fact, the book actually ends with us finding out where those plans are and if they're in motion or not. And I gotta tell you, it actually tells you what's going to be happening in the second issue. Obviously, it's pretty obvious once you see that final page, and man, it is a big one. It's one of those I have to grab the second issue now kind of moments. The cover of this book actually reminds me why I love this book when Greg Pak and Jai Lee were doing it all those years ago when they teamed up for it. Even though there's still continuity involved in this particular one, it still feels like it's different from the rest of the Batman and Superman books that are out there, and there are plenty. So, I mean, there are a couple of very shocking moments in this very first issue alone that really gets highlighted by the art by Dave Marquez. I mean, those moments really matter in a book, and when you have a great artist that brings them to life, it just makes it jump out even more, especially that final page that I'm talking about. You could do that and it would still matter, but without a great artist to bring that out, it doesn't matter as much. And that was always one of the strengths to me about the Batman Superman title in the first place. I'm glad to see that that's kind of something that's continuing in this new incarnation. This book really has like that big event feel without all of the hype that leads up to something like that. So I love that it goes there and it takes some very interesting turns. This is a pull for me. I cannot wait already to get this second issue. This is another book that really, really intrigued me when I first saw it, and it is the return of Dr. Mirage for an ongoing series from Valiant Entertainment. Magdalene Visaggio doing the writing, Nick Robles on the art, Jordi Belair on the colors, and Dave Sharp on the letters. Now, you just hear that creative team and you go, wow, that's a really strong team. And I'm not saying that Dr. Mirage isn't an important character, but you get a team like that together for a character like Dr. Mirage, who isn't like the biggest character in comics, and you know that Valiant is really pulling out all the stops for this book. Now, Shan has lost her connection to the dead side. And again, this is spoiler-free, but that is something that was in the description, so that's not like this huge spoiler or anything. She can't see her husband anymore, any other ghosts for that matter, or any other dead people. So it kind of raises an interesting point about her being alone for the first time in almost in her entire life. Think about having an always constant presence in your life from when you were like a toddler all the way through adulthood, and then all of a sudden, gone. Now, albeit unconventional, but still, literally a constant presence is not there for her anymore. So, of course, she wants to undo it, get it back to the way it was, but that leads to some unexpected results and some unexpected company. Now, it's really hard to talk too much more about this from here without spoiling anything, but what it does set up actually is something that's kind of a matter of trust and existentialism, and it's really, really intriguing. I mean, whether what Shan is being told is true or not by what's going on in this story that I can't spoil for you, the journey to find out should be one hell of an interesting ride. I'm really interested to see where this goes. So whether or not she's being fed a line of BS or the truth, or she's actually being told the truth, either way, the story works out good for me. And that's not an easy thing to pull off, because you want that level of mystery in a book like this. You kind of feel like you think you know what's going on, but maybe you're not. And that's comics sometimes, right? And that's one of the reasons why we love reading them. So to me, this is one of those rare instances, though, where I'm like, either way this decides to turn, I'm good, because the route to get there should be pretty interesting. And while the art is very good in this book, you have to give major props to Jordi Belair's colors. And when you read this book, you'll totally understand that. Maybe you've even seen some of the preview pages on Valiant's website. You absolutely understand it, and you understand why Jordi is an Eisner winner. This is the kind of stuff you need to bring out a book just like this. You can't do this book without a good colorist. So why not go out there and get the best colorist you can get and let things pop from there? This is like bringing Legion into the Valiant universe as far as the television series of Legion. You bring that in, and that's kind of on a very different level what you're getting with Dr. Mirage. And how could you do that without a good colorist? And a good artist, by the way. Nick Robles, again, fantastic job. Not saying Nick doesn't do a fantastic job here, but without Jordi, you really can't do this. You absolutely positively can't pull this off. You see a book like this, and you completely understand how Jordi Belair is an Eisner winner. And I love ghost stories anyway. And this isn't necessarily a ghost story, but it's that connection. And even talking about the dead side, which has been a big part of a lot of books that Valiant has been doing lately. And I think this is going to be a really, really cool story. So I can't wait to read more Dr. Mirage. Number one's a pull for me. Let's see if the rest of the series is the same way as well. I kind of have a feeling that it's going to be. That's going to do it for what we're reading. Up next, what are we going to be reviewing for this week in Geektainment? Did something different last week. Will it be that way again this week? Let's make it a surprise. Next, on the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
This is Breanne Howie from Fox's The Passage, and you're listening to the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
I know I've been talking about it a lot, but damn it, I am not done. So let's talk about season one of Carnival Row, finally out, by the way, on Amazon Prime Video. So as of you listening to this, you might already be done streaming it. You might have binge watched it over the Labor Day weekend, but just in case, I am going to go spoiler free here. And I know you might think, oh, you've already done that with the first episode. Come on. But this time I'm going to talk about the entire season, not just the first episode. And I got to tell you, when you look at this show and the trailers that have come out and the character descriptions and stuff like that, I mean, you could think that it's about a certain thing, right? You could think that it would be about refugees. You could think it could just be about a love story. You could just think it could be about these mystical creatures and what's going on. But the great thing about Carnival Row is that it's so many things that are combined so well that it really blows my mind how they did this without it being cluttered. Because yes, there is a major love story between Philo and Vignette, and it's tragic and it's amazing, and the way it's weaved together is so amazing and perfect in one season that it's just incredibly well done. I really have a hard time to even put it into words, and there are so many other factors there outside of that. And then when you get to see, and I believe it's episode 3, correct me if I'm wrong on that, that's your flashback episode, where you find out how they meet, how they fall in love, and you find out something major about Philo's character that really, really explains why he is the way he is, not just in the first couple of episodes, but throughout the rest of this first season as well, and why he cares so much about what he does for a living as well, and why he is a little bit more of a tortured soul than you might expect. So that really goes a long way into explaining his character, but does it excuse his behavior as how it relates to Vignette? You might have seen the clip that I released on the Down and Nerdy Podcast YouTube page that was provided by Amazon Studios about how she confronts him about leaving her. Well, you get to find out why that happens and who is involved in that too, by the way. Another very, very familiar name and a friend. This really isn't a spoiler, so I'm going to go ahead and talk about this. Tourmaline, who is a very, very close fae friend of Vignette. Actually, there's a little bit more to it than that, but we will talk. That's something, again, you'll find out as you watch the show. So she's very much a part of this story as well, and maybe your feelings change about her one way or another based on the things that you find out as the season progresses and as you find out that information in the early part of the season. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe you find a place to where you place blame. Maybe you don't. Maybe you just root for these two to someday get back to where they were, because it just seems like that's the right thing to do, right? But then Philo has his own story at some point during the season, where he's got his case that he needs to solve. Vignette has her own part of her story, which is so much a story of survival too, by the way. And you look at how strong Cara Delevingne is in this season. I said this about the first episode, but it just keeps proving itself throughout each episode after that, and how amazing she is and how strong she is. Because Vignette is someone that could have, it's a character that could have been broken so many times in her past and in her present. Really could have been broken, but just finds a way to fight through it. And you know, there's a certain point where even the strongest of us breaks down at sometimes, right? But that's also part of being strong, I think, is that every now and then you just break down because there are certain things that certain buttons get pushed or certain things that happen, and it's just too much, and you've got to let that emotion out somewhere. So her story, to me, and the way it plays out, and just the character Vignette in general, is so, I mean, maybe inspiring is a cliche word, but it's someone that you watch with, I watch with this utter fascination of not only how she is who she is, but how she presents herself and how she carries herself and how just incredible she is in each and every episode of the show, past and present. Because when you meet Vignette, she's already a badass in the past. This is not something that just sort of happened because of the tragedy that happened to her in this war when the Burgishmen meet the Fae. That is, and she meets Philo. That's not when it happened. She's already there. She's already a badass before that anyway. But then you see that sort of transform a little bit and sort of morph, and it's just really, really amazing how that's done. And yes, there is also a class system involved here. And there is a, you have these creatures, you have the Pucks and the Critch that they call them, and the Fae, and these different creatures that are now being integrated into the society of humans, and humans aren't sure exactly how to take that. And some of them have very strong feelings about it, and some of it's very, very much not cool. And then you've got, you know, the upper class society who wants nothing to do with quote unquote their kind. And I gotta tell you, first of all, Imogen Spurnrose, who's played by Tamsin Merchant, she's one of those characters. She's so conniving, right? And you kind of, you almost feel bad for her for like a second at one point during the show. Then you don't really feel bad for her at all at this point. And she's just so manipulative and cunning. She's like the kind of person with money that scares you the most because you don't know what she's really capable of, because she tries to hide it behind this like naivety sort of thing. So you got to kind of watch her more than most. And I felt that so interesting and compelling about her character. And by the way, her brother, who's a complete moron on the show, by the way, Ezra Spurnrose, who's played by Andrew Gower. Now, here's the thing about Andrew Gower, and this is going to be a little bit of a tangent on my part, but just follow me on this. Now, if you remember, if you're an Outlander fan, Andrew Gower was also on Outlander. He played Prince Charles Edward Stuart, and he would always say, "Mark me, mark me." And he was the guy with like the terrible plan for the Jacobite army in Outlander. And again, I don't want to get too much of a tangent here, but he also kind of makes a couple huge mistakes in Carnival Row with his family and how that whole thing is going. And there's a scene where Imogen's trying to turn their fortunes around, I guess you could say, in a certain stance. And she is talking to the Puck that has bought, by the way, baller move, by the way, by David Gossie's character of Agrius, who buys the biggest house in the richest neighborhood as a Puck with a human servant and just waltzes in there sight unseen. Nobody knows what to expect. And now Imogen started trying to play him, right? But he isn't having it. So long story short, he says at one point, he says to her, "Mark me, Imogen, mark me." And I'm like, you stole his line. You stole dude's line. You stole Andrew Gower's line, because I feel like that's his at this point. I know this is a ridiculous tangent on my part, but if you watch both shows, and if you were as aggravated with Andrew Gower's characters in both shows as I was, that was just kind of a moment for me. Where I'm like, really? You're going to use that? That's the verbiage you're going to use. Okay. And I'm not even saying that that's an Outlander Easter egg in any way. I just thought that that was a completely unnecessary tangent on my part. But it was fun for me. So if you watch both shows, you'll know exactly what I'm saying. But it's that class system manipulation, right, that I really, really love. And you see that. And that's not something that you necessarily get to see play out as prominent in our current society, right? Like, you know it's there, but it's not as out there as it is in a system like this, in a show like Carnival Row, where it's completely obvious, just like it was in the time of Kings and Queens, right? That was just something that was so prominent, and that still exists in a prominent way, but it's like the one thing in our society that's not as outward as it was back then. Whereas there's so much stuff in our society now that's just out there, but this for some reason isn't. And I think that Carnival Row paints an interesting spotlight on that. It's like, why are we not talking about this now, sort of thing. So I think that that's part of it too. And then you've got the refugee story and how they're treated. You've also got this monster, by the way, that's terrorizing the Fae folk, and Philo's trying to figure out what's going on there. And then you also have the political, by the way, aspect of everything that's going on. And you've got the Chancellor who's trying to hold on to his power, and there's somebody that is very much trying to unseat him from that power. And who that is, by the way, I did not see coming. This Breakspear family is very interesting. Let's just say that for right now. But what happens with them, I did not see that coming, and I wasn't sure where it was going to go until the season played out a little bit more. And I got to tell you, it's dark, man. It is really, really dark. And it was one of the cool, it was one of the cool surprises for me of the show that they let that play out the way it is. And then there's a group that Vignette gets involved with as well that's really, really hardcore, and that has a lot to change for her story. But my main theme that I want to go back to here about Carnival Row is that it's a show about not a specific thing. It's a show about so many different things that somehow all comes together to make this beautiful story that they call Carnival Row. That it just is able to work so many issues in society from not just back then, but to put it in the perspective of how things are maybe today and how things might be seen today, put in the context of a show like this and dealt with all in one complete show where everything sort of works together on its own. And again, I've said this before about certain things, but that when you have separate stories and you're taking me off, like maybe you're really enjoying Philo's story, but we also have to talk about Imogen's story as well. I don't get upset by being taken away from one story to go to another because they all have their own interesting aspects, and it all kind of fits into the larger scheme of what's going on in Carnival Row. And it also plays to the theme of the society itself and how it got from the Burgish and the Fae getting along so well and everything going so smoothly to where things are now. How did we get to the point where we are now? Because I think in society, when you reach a point where you feel like things are not right, the question it eventually comes up of, well, how did we get there? And you try to trace that back. And Carnival Row actually does that. It's like, well, how did we get here? Okay, well, here's maybe how we got there. Maybe not a definitive answer, but here's a little peek into how things might have gone the way they're gone, and here's the way things are now, and who's willing to change these things and who isn't, and who's willing to take certain risks and who isn't, and what are those consequences. And those are some of the main things that I loved about Carnival Row. I'm already excited. It's already announced for a season 2. Well, well deserved. Make sure you are binge watching Carnival Row on Amazon Prime Video. If you haven't started watching it already, you will not be sorry if you start watching it now. And hey, watch it again. I certainly know I'm going to be doing that. That's going to do it for my spoiler-free review of season 1 of Carnival Row from Amazon Prime Video. Watch it and get the prequel comics too, by the way, from Comixology, because they're free and they're awesome. Coming up next, got some nerd news to talk about. We'll even do some D23 stuff on the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
Hi, this is Sierra Nay, and I play Hawkgirl on DC's Legends of Tomorrow, and you're listening to the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
I'm going to take you back to D23 a little bit. It's time for nerd news. It was kind of a slow news week anyway, so I thought I actually would go back and talk about some of the stuff that happened at D23 Expo last weekend from Disney, and that means a lot of Marvel stuff, a lot of Star Wars stuff. And let's start, actually, with the trailers. And I want to start with The Mandalorian, because I think that might be the most anticipated of anything Star Wars related anyway. And I know that's kind of heavy-handed to say when you get Rise of Skywalker coming out. But the reason I say Mandalorian's a little bit more anticipated is because we kind of know what to expect thematically from Rise of Skywalker, don't we? We kind of know this, the third part of the trilogy, so it's not like this is something that's going to come out and shock us, and we don't really know what to expect. We at least have some idea of what to expect. With The Mandalorian, we really had no idea what to expect until we got this teaser. And I'm still not really sure we know what to expect. But what we are going to get is it's definitely going to be very bounty hunter heavy. It's got this real Western feel to it, doesn't it? And that's not something that I'm used to from a Star Wars universe. Maybe I'm the only one that feels that way, but it feels like this gritty Western type thing, right? But with a bounty hunter vibe at the same time. And what I loved about this trailer right off the get was the stormtrooper helmets on stakes, right? And to me, you're starting off your trailer with that. And to me, visually, what that tells me is, you know that thing you remember about Star Wars? That's dead now. We're doing this, and it's going to be different. That's what that says to me. To me, I could be reading way too much into a, 5-second part of this trailer. But what that says to me is, this is us getting ready to do something different now, and hopefully you're going to be on board with it. We get a lot of the cool visuals, right? You know, we get to see some of the bounty hunters. We've already seen the Mandalorian. We get a look at Carl Weathers. We get a look at Gina Carano and some of the other characters. But they're just brief looks. And, you know, and you get a couple lines here and there. But you get to see how on the outer edges of the galaxy this place really is that the Mandalorian's going to be taking place in. So I think if nothing else, this showed us that this is going to be different from what we're used to from Star Wars, and I'm not sure that that's a bad thing. I think that's something that we could certainly use at this point. But moving on from that, yeah, let's talk about the Star Wars Rise of the Skywalker footage, sizzle reel, whatever you want to call it, that was shown at D23, because it seems like the only thing anyone wants to talk about is Dark Rey and the lightsaber that bends or spins or whatever you want to call it, and what's going on there. And there's been a lot of theories out on Twitter. By the way, theories are theories. Can we just get that out of the way now? And that it's okay to have a theory. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen. I see people get really mad about theories. Like there was one, and I can't remember who started it, by the way, so I apologize for not giving necessarily proper credit, because this could have been started by anybody, actually. And that's that Palpatine is actually Rey's father, and it's Kylo that's going to have to rise up to stop her. Which would be interesting. I mean, that would certainly be an interesting theory, but it could be that this whole Dark Rey thing is just a force dream, or it's some sort of projection of what could happen should she go a certain way. It's not like this is something that we haven't seen in Star Wars before, okay? So it's, again, it feels like we're doing something a little different, but not reinventing the wheel here with Star Wars Rise of Skywalker. And I'm really curious to see how it ends. It seems like the cast is certainly excited about it from what they talked about at D23. And I'm not going to go ad nauseum through what they said, but everybody seems to be really excited about the ending and thinks that fans are going to be as well. You've got the red-eyed C-3PO, and I've said this before, and I'll say it again. If this is where C-3PO just finally loses it and picks up a weapon and starts just fighting for the cause, like hardcore fighting for the cause, I think that would be awesome. I would cheer for that. Absolutely. I think that it's been a long time coming for C-3PO. You know, you think he's the scared one all the time, then all of a sudden, he's like, you know what? No. Not this time. Not going to do it. I'm actually going to stand up and fight. I think that would be really, really neat. But I understand that maybe there's some fans that are, you know, you're done with the Skywalker saga. You don't want to see any more, and you don't care necessarily, and you want the Mandalorian more than this, and you're going to get Mandalorian before this. I totally understand that, okay? I totally understand the fatigue with this story, but you can't dump on people that are excited about it, first of all. And second of all, there are some of us who want to see, right, wrong, or indifferent, how this story actually is going to end. And if this is the end, how does it end? And what does it mean for the new characters that were introduced in this saga? Is this something that they want to continue with? So I don't necessarily think that this footage did anything one way or the other to move the needle as to the excitement or disappointment of Rise of Skywalker. I think this is still a wait and see type of deal, and I'm not sure anything that they could put out in a trailer that would really change anybody's minds at this point. I think minds are made up until the movie actually comes out. Here's something that I wanted to talk about only, well, not for a couple of different reasons, and that's the final trailer for the Joker movie that's going to be coming out here in a couple in a few weeks here in October. First of all, I cannot freaking wait for this movie. I think Joaquin Phoenix is going to be fantastic, and every trailer that we get shows me that. You've got Zazie Beetz. We actually get to see her a little bit. But one thing I really love that this trailer highlighted more than others is how Arthur, which is his name in the movie before he's Joker, is getting pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. And there's always the argument of, does Batman create the Joker? Is Batman responsible for the creation of the greatest villains that he has to face? That's always a debate among fans, right? Well, if Batman's really not going to be a part of this movie, and it doesn't seem like he is, if at all, this could be our, what if Batman has nothing to do with it? What if Batman isn't the problem? What if the Joker just gets pushed to the point of, this is how I became the villain that I am, and it's not necessarily because of the hero that goes against me, or the anti-hero, however you want to describe Batman. Let's not even get into that debate right now. But to me, this movie's saying, what if it happened this way? And I love that about it already. We get to see how, you know, Robert De Niro pushes him a little bit. We even get to see how the therapist that Arthur sees kind of pushes him a little bit into the direction of, nobody's paying attention to me. And then once he starts getting that attention, negative as it may be, he starts to thrive on that. And I'm not saying that that's how the creation happens. I haven't seen the movie yet. I can't judge it until I see it. But I love the fact that it looks like we're looking at a different angle of how this could have actually happened, with maybe winks and nods to Killing Joke here and there. But there's one thing I really want to talk about, and I mentioned something about this on Twitter too, as a matter of fact. I understand there's excitement here. I can't wait to see this movie either. I think it's going to be fantastic. I think Joaquin Phoenix is going to be fantastic. But can we not use the O word because of trailers? We can't talk about Oscars, guys. We can't. We cannot start talking about giving out trophies for trailers, okay? If you want to have a trailer awards, fine. Let's do that. We have no idea how this movie's really going to be based on several 2.5 minute trailers or 1 minute teasers or 30 second teasers or photos. We can't possibly know. Yes, it looks like Joaquin Phoenix is going to be great, and there's going to be some other great performances as well. And maybe this is that comic book movie that finally gets nominated and wins Best Picture. And we have Joaquin Phoenix getting nominated and winning Best Actor for playing the Joker. These are things that, yeah, could happen, but that could happen in a lot of other cases too, because we haven't seen it yet. Stop. Let's see movies before we judge them. Okay, you cannot say that a movie was awful if you didn't see it. I'm sorry. You just can't. You also can't say a movie was great or a performance was great if you didn't see it. Let's watch things, then judge them. That's the order that this is supposed to go in. I understand we are an instant gratification 2019 social media society now, but there are certain carts that just cannot be put before the horse, and that's my old man saying that I'm going to drop in here before we move on. Let's talk about some more D23 stuff, and I'm going to kind of go a little bit, and let's talk about The Mandalorian first, because there was one story that was really, really interesting that sort of dropped, and it had to do with Ming-Na Wen, who received an award at D23, and before we even started talking about Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., we find out that Ming-Na Wen is joining the cast of The Mandalorian in a mysterious role. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean she's going to be playing a character that we know at all. She might not be playing anybody that we know, period. But there, you still want to keep who she's going to be playing under wraps, and I'm okay with that. And after seeing the trailer and how gritty it is, And she just fits the vibe of this show to me. I really, really think that she's going to fit in well. And it's really cool to see her move off something like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and go into the Star Wars universe with The Mandalorian. So if you're going to start from scratch and you're going to start, you know, doing something a little bit new, getting somebody like Ming-Na Wen on your side, yeah, I think that that's a really good call. So I'm glad that they decided to do that. Of course, we've got the Obi-Wan Kenobi series that has been confirmed as well from the Star Wars universe. Yes, Ewan McGregor is going to be back. And we just found out, actually, from Collider that as far as timelines go, this is going to take place 8 years after Revenge of the Sith. So we assume that, you know, Obi-Wan's had plenty of time to dwell on the fact that you were supposed to be the chosen one and you weren't, and he cuts Anakin to pieces and you know how that ends. So he's had plenty of time to dwell on that, and could this be about, you know, his exile and stuff like that, or where he was going, what he was doing, how that sort of transpired. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to it than that, because, you know, just him trying to find a good hiding spot for himself is probably not an interesting premise for a show. So I just think that it's really interesting to set it in that timeline, but I actually think that 8 years is a good amount to be able to go. And, I mean, Ewan McGregor was a really bright spot of those prequels, so having Kenobi, a Star Wars story, on Disney Plus as a series, I think is going to be really, really cool. It looks like filming's going to start, not going to start until 2020, so, we're certainly not going to get this before 2021, I wouldn't think. And there are timelines that were kind of released at D23, but not completely released. But one thing that we do know, if you want to switch to the Marvel realm, is that there were some more Disney Plus series that were announced. We already have the laundry list of series that are going to be coming, like WandaVision and Falcon and Winter Soldier. Well, apparently, after all that's done and at the tail end of Phase 4, we're going to be getting a She-Hulk series, we're going to get a Moon Knight series, and we're finally going to get a Miss Marvel series. Yes, Kamala Khan is finally going to be joining the MCU. And can I tell you how great I think it is that it's going to be a series instead of a movie? And I'm not saying that because I don't think that Miss Marvel can carry her own movie. I absolutely think she can. I think this is a great opportunity to dive deeper into her story and get fans to really love and appreciate this character more, because you've got more time, you've got more episodes. They're going to stretch this thing out. Looks like Disney Plus isn't going to release all episodes at once. They're going to do the weekly thing like DC Universe has been doing with Titans and Doom Patrol and stuff like that. And by the way, I have no problem with that. But when The Hollywood Reporter tells me that Bashi K. Ali is going to be writing this series and being the showrunner, I think that that's a great call. I really, really hope we get Squirrel Girl in here at some point so we have that BFF relationship that we get from Marvel Rising. I think that would be really, really cool. I'm not saying that she has to be like a sidekick of the show or a part of the show, a big part. Just give me like an episode, or even like towards the tail end of the series, introduce that. I think that could be really, really neat. But I think that you taking the time to tell her story the right way and to really be able to dive deeper into it, I think that that's a great decision that was made on their part to go ahead and do that. But and as far as Moon Knight is concerned, same thing. This is a really complicated, multi-personality type of character that you really cannot necessarily get fans to understand the story of in just one movie. I mean, you'd have to do so much laying the groundwork in a movie that by the time the movie was over, you really don't get a chance to do anything. It's not like a character like Venom, where you can kind of jump right in because you sort of get the premise already, right? With a character like Moon Knight, you've got to set the stage, because the casual fan is not going to know who Moon Knight is and the complicated part about his story. And I really don't want to get into who might play him and casting and all that stuff. All I'm saying is, again, I think this is a good choice for a series. As far as She-Hulk goes, this is one I actually thought would end up on ABC, that female-led Marvel series that's supposedly being worked on for ABC, which we heard nothing about at D23, which I thought was very interesting. Again, remember I said, don't be so sure about that one. Let's let that one just kind of hang out a little bit. Not sure that's actually going to happen. So again, I want to keep my eye on that. But it'll be interesting to see how much of her origin is going to be tied to Bruce Banner, and if we will see Mark Ruffalo at least make some sort of appearance on the show, or if he'll just be alluded to. I'm not saying he's got to be a huge part of it, but I mean, her origin kind of tied to that a little bit, right? So I think it would be neat to at least make that a part of it. And I think bringing She-Hulk into the MCU is a great call anyway. Can't wait to see what they do with casting on She-Hulk and exactly who they're going to get. I think that actually a lot of these roles you might see go to some unknowns only because you're spending so much money on your Marvel Studios characters anyway with some of these other shows. I know it's Disney and I know they've got a ton of money, but I don't know how much of it they're going to want to keep spending on a lot of these other series. So unless they've got a really, really good feeling about some of these, I think we might see some lesser known names that are going to be attached to this. And I don't think we'll see even one of these until at least 2022, just because of the huge schedule that they've already got in here. I want to work some of this stuff in really quickly. We've got Black Panther 2 that is going to be coming out. It looks like that has been confirmed for May 6th of 2022. Speaking of 2022, Ryan Coogler is going to be back. So the way I see it, we've got at least a year for Marvel to figure out the whole Namor thing, because I want that Atlantean Wakandan battle. I need it. I think that would be a perfect thing to do for Black Panther 2. But again, we've got the whole it's connected thing in the cinematic universe. And how does that fit in? Can you do that? I think you can. And I really hope they figure the Namor thing out. Just from a comic book fan standpoint alone, I really, really want to see that. And I hope that they get a chance to do it. As far as Eternals is concerned, we got a little bit of news there. We know that that's going to be coming out November 6th on 2020. And we got a first look at some of the costumes, and they look pretty darn good to me. I'm not going to dive into all of them because, quite frankly, there's a lot. Kit Harington from Game of Thrones fame. That's right, Jon Snow is coming to the MCU. He's going to be playing Black Knight in Eternals, which, I mean, really makes sense. And, I mean, he gets to be reunited with Brother Rob, right, from Game of Thrones. So that'll be pretty cool to see them sharing the screen again together. I still think that I'm not completely sold that Eternals is going to be a huge hit just based on the names that are involved in it. I still think it's a little bit of a gamble. But again, you throw that Marvel Studios logo on stuff, and sometimes it just doesn't matter. With all the stuff that happened with D23, I do want to get one quick DC movie story in. And I think it's interesting because fans have been waiting for this name to join the DC universe in live action for a long time. And now you finally got Nathan Fillion, according to Deadline, being cast in James Gunn's Suicide Squad movie. By the way, James Gunn said this is not Suicide Squad 2, so I'm not going to call it that anymore. So James, just tell us what we're supposed to call it. I'll just call it the Suicide Squad movie from James Gunn from here on out. But here's the deal. Again, this is another one of those mystery role type things, and yep, the fan speculation has been running rampant. I know you want him to play Hal Jordan. I know you do. Totally get it. Not saying I don't want him to play Hal Jordan. I think that that would be great. I also don't necessarily think that that's going to happen. The other thing is, he could be Booster Gold. He could easily be Booster Gold in this movie. We know so little about Suicide Squad from James Gunn that there's no possible way to know who Fillion's going to be playing. And would Green Lantern even make sense in this movie that's going to have Polka Dot Man and Rat Catcher and King Shark in it? I don't know that he would make sense. I have no clue what this is going to be about, what the direction is going to be. We're not even sure exactly who's going to be returning. I mean, we know that we do have Joel Kinnaman's going to be back as Rick Flagg, Jai Courtney as Captain Boomerang, Viola Davis, and it certainly seems like Margot Robbie is going to be back as well. So we know that. But at the same time, as far as villains are concerned, a whole bunch of other things, we just don't know. So we're very much in a wait-and-see approach. There's still nothing wrong with the fact that Nathan Fillion is going to be in this movie. And we don't know. The fact that we don't know who he's going to play is either going to be one of two things. It's going to be a huge, huge deal or a tremendous cameo-style letdown. Remember when we found out that Joe Manganiello was going to be playing Deathstroke? That ended up kind of just being a cameo thing just to introduce the character. And where is that now? So I'm going to hold off being excited about this until I know a little bit more about what's going on and when we're going to get that information. Who knows? It might not even be until, could be a while. So I'm going to hold off on this and see what happens. That's going to do it for Nerd News. Up next, going to talk to Cinna Grace about Ghosted in LA, and a little bit of an appearance from Ryan Parrott as well. We'll talk to them next on the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
Hi, this is Rioter Ryan Parrott, and you're listening to the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
San Diego Comic-Con 2019, the 50th anniversary of San Diego Comic-Con. As a matter of fact, I can't think of a better way to celebrate than talking about some great books from Boom Studios, Boombox, and the other 1,000 imprints that they might have. And we just happen to have Cena Grace and Ryan Parrott both joining me at the same time, gentlemen.
Hey, hi.
Hey, hey.
So this is interesting getting to talk to both of you at the same time when you've both got some great things going on right now. Cena, let's start with you. Ghosted in L.A., you already have the first issue out. What's the response been like for that first issue so far?
I'm still waiting for the ball to drop because everyone's like, I liked it, which is scary when you're doing a book that feels like you're just telling the story you want to tell and like not worrying about the reader, because I have the best editor, one of the best editors in the world, Shannon Waters, on it, and she's really given me a lot of freedom to just basically kind of carve out a narrative that is, again, speaking to kind of like my soul. So it's been great. People really like it. It's a book about a young girl who moves to LA and is trying to find herself and define herself, all while living in an apartment complex that is housed entirely by ghosts.
With Ghosted in LA, which I reviewed on the show not too long ago and loved it, one of the things that drew to me the most was the character of Daphne. She's like kind of not necessarily a free spirit, but like she wants to be a free spirit more. Talk about her a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, basically, like, someone was like asking me, like, what about her is like you? And I was like, nothing. Like, I've always known what I wanted to do. I've always wanted to be in comic books. And, you know, knock on wood, I think it worked out for me. And then also just, yeah, like, I'm from Los Angeles. So it was sort of, as a writer, putting myself in an uncomfortable position of, like, how do I challenge myself to write someone who is on a quest for self-discovery? But, yeah, she's this awesome person who, like, anything is possible for her, and she just kind of has to figure it out. And what's great about having these ghosts is she's kind of living with these sort of metaphors for, like, what could happen to you, like, if you do make the right or wrong decision, or if you do double down on this or that. And so, I don't know, I just, like, really like her, and I wanted to create this character that was not so archetypal, very complicated, but earnest. I love earnest characters, and Daphne is very that. So it's just been great to kind of do a coming-of-age story that I hadn't quite seen in pop culture, and I like her because she's not quite, like, she's not a good girl. Like, I think in the first issue she literally implies that she's, like, you know, she's in a sexual relationship with her now ex-boyfriend, and at Boom they're like, yeah, like, she's 18, like, duh, she's most likely having, you know, consensual sex. So yeah, I really wanted to make this character kind of look and feel like people I knew in college, and I wanted it to, you were talking about this earlier in a previous, Ryan and I are like, we're on an interview kind of stampede today, it's really fun, press junket,
yeah.
But it's great to kind of give flesh to friendships and relationships that I had in high school that I haven't seen in pop culture. Like, I think especially with, you know, 18-year-old girls and their BFFs and their boyfriends, there's always just sort of a rhythm, and I didn't want to do that. I kind of wanted to, like, and I also didn't want to do a Betty and Veronica thing, and so I'm just kind of trying to create, you know, I'm just trying to add to the you know, tapestry of stories out there.
I remember when you pitched me the book, you were like, oh, it's Melrose Place with ghosts. I was like, that's fucking genius. Sorry if you can't swear, but that was...
No, you can. Feel free.
Yeah, I just thought that was the best idea, because, like, I automatically kind of knew the tone you wanted. It was like a contemporary version of the fact that those people were not perfect and that they made a lot of mistakes and stuff like that. I don't know if I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's what I really liked about it.
Oh my God, Ryan's, like, such a better hype man than I am.
Maybe you should just hype each other's books.
Yeah, that's what we're here for. God.
We definitely don't want to give away too much about Ghosted in LA either, but I know the second issue comes out on August 14th, I think it is, so
Spoiler, I didn't realize.
We don't know a whole lot about the ghosts in Ryecroft Manor too much yet, so what are maybe one or two of your most favorite characters of that group to bring out?
Yeah, well, I think so. The head of the household, Aggie, she's really cool, and at the beginning of issue two, you find out that, like, when she was alive was sort of at the era of history when, you know, silent movies were becoming talkies, and it's okay to kind of admit that, or it's okay to share that, you know, well, it's my book, so I can share whatever the heck I want. But it's okay to share that basically, like, she is divorced, and basically she's, like, using her settlement money, or her, you know, whatever her ex-husband is giving her, because he ghosts her, essentially, and the settlement is, like, his last message to her. And so she uses it to buy this apartment complex, which, even in that, those first three pages, you're kind of, like, Steven Universe level, like, dropped another nugget of, like, oh, like, in eight issues, you're going to find out, like, that one sentence meant something. But, like, the building itself already has a history by the time Aggie gets the building. And so she's a really lovely character, and then I'm really excited for people to just get to know, I don't even think he's been name-checked yet in the first issue, but there's a ghost named Bernard, there's a ghost named Ricky, he's so sweet, he's like the little quiet one that, like, says something sort of, like, kind and endearing right as Daphne, like, decides to ask if she can stay there, and it's great. They all are just such fragile, beautiful people, and I just can't wait to, like, even though they're incorporeal, I can't wait to give them flesh.
So Ryan's going to do his crossover. Is there a crossover that you have that you might want to do at some point?
I don't... Well, you know what's funny is I get to live the best world with this book. Yeah, I want to do a go-go, no. No, it's what's great about it is that we're going to be using, like, real locations, real bands, real personalities. Like, there's in the second arc, there's kind of this, like, big, like, all right, show someone around L.A. sequence, and I think we're going to actually get these characters to go to, like, a comedy show where, like, they're going to get to see these comedians talk, and I've already, like, gotten them to sign release forms, and so I think that's the best kind of team-up ever is, like, this fiction universe with, like, the real Los Angeles. But yeah, maybe I'll ask Daphne for 2020 to do a go-go.
Can I ask a question about this?
Yeah.
So with the ghosts, are you going to learn, like, are you going to see flashbacks about who they were and how they got there and all that stuff?
Yeah.
So are you going to do something similar to, like L.A. Plays Itself, where you get to see sort of L.A. changing at the same time as the characters a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Well, because I'm reading this book called Dear Los Angeles, and it's just, like, postcards and letters about L.A., and there was, like, one thing that was, like, written in the 60s, and someone was talking about Century City being developed, and I was like, oh, right, duh, this, like, this whole city, it was, like, it's a reaction. Like, L.A. was not planned, like, you know. And so, like, I have, like, this, like, little throwaway line about this curmudgeon character getting pissed off that the Century City development's going to cause all this traffic, and it kind of alludes to why he just keeps kind of putting himself further and further in his little hole, and why he's ghosting himself from the world, because he's just building his, like, you know, like, if you can get your home life right, you don't ever have to leave. Like, you go to the grocery store, you got your TV dinners, but no, yeah, it's LA is gonna, it's the history of LA is very important to
awesome.
Some macro things
cool.
happening. Yeah, I'm having a blast. Yeah.
So before I let you guys go, I want to talk about the respective artists on your books, because I feel like you both got with Turtles as well, you've gotten really lucky with the artists that you've been able to work with. So talk a little bit about Siobhan Sennett, and of course for you, Danielle Ryan.
Yeah, with Siobhan Keenan, we worked together on a Gem and the Holograms one shot for IDW, and I had met her when she was doing Clueless here for Boom, and she's just, like, the nicest and also, like, coolest person, and amazing with deadlines, and that's just such a hard thing to find in one individual. So when Ghosted came up, and I was very clear that I was like, I'll draw sequences, but I don't want to draw the whole book, she was number one on my list, and before I sent Shannon Waters my list, I, like, messaged her, and I was like, hey, like, what's your calendar like? Can you do, you know, a 12-issue series? And she was like, yeah, I'm around. And so I was like, here's my list. By the way, Siobhan's free. and she's just rad, because she, like me, I think she understands how, like, a set and how wardrobe and how demeanor can tell the reader so much about a character and a place, and that's super important with a book that, like, you know, is like 90% just like indoors, you know, with like a set cast. So she's awesome, and it's, I don't know, I love her.
So make sure you're going to boom-studios.com for all the release dates for all the great books. Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, of course, Power Rangers Go, and then of course you've got Ghosted in LA as well, and Cena's got some other stuff, so does Ryan's. Make sure you just go to boom-studios.com because there's a ton of it up there. Cena Grace, Ryan Perry, gentlemen, thank you both for joining me at the same time.
Thank you
very much, man.
One thing I really love about Ghosted in LA, not just the main character herself, but just how fun it is and how quirky and interesting, and then you've got all these different ghost characters mixed in that have their own personalities. And you're mixing this in a way that I think a lot of different age groups can enjoy this. Not just the young adult and the teen age range, but, I mean, I'm 40 years old, and I love how fun this book is. So make sure you're getting Ghosted in L.A. number 3 when it comes out on September the 11th at your local comic book shops. Also, you can pick up issues 1 and 2 that are out right now as well. And don't forget to make sure you're reading the Ryan Parrott run for Power Rangers as well. And yes, I'll have more of this interview as we get closer to the release of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Power Rangers crossover. Ryan Parrott had some pretty interesting things to say about that as well. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the Down and Nerdy Podcast. Again, thanks to the folks at Boom Studios for letting me talk to Cena Grace and Ryan Parrott at San Diego Comic-Con this year. Going to go back to the con next week and talk about Amazon Studios' Undone. This is maybe the most beautiful looking animated series that I've seen in a long time, but maybe it's not an animated series. We'll hear one of the members of the cast, Rosa Salazar, and the creators of the show. Going to talk about that as well. So we'll talk about that next week. If you want more about any other shows that we've got going on or all kinds of stories, even a giveaway on our website right now, downandnerdypodcast.com. Also follow us on social media as well. Facebook.com/downandnerdy and at downandnerdy757 on Twitter and on Instagram. Remember, you never have to apologize for being a nerd, so let your fan flag fly. Be good to your fellow nerds.